Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to Season 2, Episode 2 of Psyched to be with you. I'm your host, Christopher Leach, aka Chimp195. This episode, my special guest is Dennis Rolojo Howe, absolutely fantastic chap. Dennis is a fellow PhD researcher, was the founder of the website PsychReg. We discussed all things blogging, resilience, psychology, academia, a little bit of PR information in there as well. This was a great chat. Honestly, I was a bit blown away with hearing about Dennis's background and, you know, all the things that Dennis gets up to be honest with you, really. It was a great chat. I hope you'll enjoy it as well. All the information you need to catch up with Dennis and the rest of the show are attached below to where you found this episode. Do please enjoy it now. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to be with you today. Well, you're in for a treat, I can tell you that much. This is going to be a great episode. I'm very excited. I hope you are as well. As ever, all that remains me to do right now is to pass over to my very special guest. If you could please tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, first off, thank you, Chris, for inviting me here. I'm psyched to be with you. It's a pleasure to share to you my journey and also what I do. And hopefully it could be benefit your listeners, your readers. I'm sorry, your listeners and viewers. My background, so I'm Dennis Rolojo Howe. I know that's a bit of a mouthful for a name. As you can probably tell from my accent and my name, I'm originally from the Philippines. So I think the best way for you to understand my background is for you to give you a bit of a history about my formative years. So I spent my childhood in a slum in the Philippines. I grew up in a place where there was no running water, there was no electricity. But I have to preface this story because when I share this, I don't want to elicit any, you know, like emotive, melodramatic effect. I always look at my childhood without any resentment. I look at my childhood with a sense of gratitude because that slum, that wonderful place shaped me who I am today. So just to go back to what I was saying earlier. So I did experience how it was to use a toilet or to sleep on a bed until probably I was about 15. It was quite a deprived background, but growing up, I quite enjoyed it because it's an interesting place to live. And given the chance, I think I would probably choose to grow up in a slum again. So in 2013, I came here in Britain to do a master's degree in psychology. And since then, just like most international students who stay here, fell in love with the country and just never left. And on my first year, 2014, I set up PsychReg. So basically, that's the thing that consumes most of my time and my energy. It's a platform about psychology, mental health, and wellness. And I'm also doing my PhD in clinical psychology. So right now, my research focuses on how we could use digital spaces, in particular blogging, on how we could use it to cultivate resilience in young people. Blogging, because obviously that's my passion, and resilience because it played a significant role in my life. Hopefully that give you a good snapshot of my background.
No, that's a really wonderful and concise introduction. You can tell that you're used to giving it, I think. It comes across very professional, very sort of to the point, which is great. So firstly, again, thank you for joining me on the show. I appreciate it. And thank you for sharing a bit about your background. I want to sort of pick into that a little bit more in a moment. Mm-hmm. But I will just sort of say, for the benefit of listeners, Dennis and I know each other through the cyber psychology section of the BPS. Furthermore, this is actually the second part of a duo collaboration. Dennis was nice enough to invite me onto his show a couple months back now, I think it is. I forget where we are because time is a man-made construct, right? But that was great. So Dennis is sort of fulfilling his end of the bargain here. So I'm very appreciative of that. So let's just go and then. So what was your master's in psychology? Where did you study that? What did you sort of think of that?
Yeah, so I went to University of Hertfordshire. I did a course called Research Methods in Psychology. And if I'm not mistaken, that's no longer offered. So it's a preparatory for doing a PhD. I enjoy the course because it gives me a good foundation for doing a PhD. Although at that time, I was not really sure whether I'm going to do a PhD. But about 3 years ago, I finally decided like, yeah, I have to do a PhD.
So obviously,
I was just going to say my research project during my MSc was expressive writing. So basically, this is the idea that if you give people a chance to express themselves through writing, it could provide a range of psychological benefits.
Okay, so it kind of becomes a little bit chicken and egg, I guess. You mentioned a bit about your background as well, but you mentioned that you, which sort of came first, like your business, psych reg, was it? Did that come first, before like researching the area or after?
Okay, I think the best way would be to say that it's blogging first, it's psych reg first. Because even before I came into this country, I'm already blogging, but it's not the kind of blogging that I'm doing now. I started as a personal blogger. So when I say personal blogger, basically I just share personal stuff about me, what I think about a number of things, politics being one of them, because when I was in my 20s, I was a bit interested about politics. I think it's, like when you're in 20s, you're pretty much interested about politics. And then I became a travel blogger because also when I was in my 20s, I've been traveling to different Southeast Asian countries. So, and then when I was doing my master's degrees, I realized that there's a bit of a mismatch between what I'm doing and what I'm doing academically. So I transitioned, so to speak, from being a travel blogger to being a mental health blogger. So that's when PsychReg was born. Yeah, but I suppose blogging or writing, if you will, has always been part of me, even before I started my academic journey.
Okay, that's fair enough. And then your PhD now is sort of built on top of that. How's that sort of going? Because one of the classic questions is, why are you researching what you're researching? You know, that's kind of quite clear. But how were you able to sell it to like a uni, I guess?
Yeah. Why you're researching what you're researching? I guess the honest answer would be because I found a supervisor. because I just want to create, I just want to do a research project which is I'm familiar with, and I'm passionate about resilience. I know the word passionate has been overly used nowadays, but I'm passionate about blogging. I'm passionate about resilience because, like what I've said, it plays a significant role in my life, and blogging because it has become a source of income, and resilience because that's what I gain from, from my parents and also from a number of people. And I suppose if not from the help of other people and not from resilience, I would still be living in a slum in a third world country. And so the kind of main message of my research project is that if we give young people the opportunity to realize that they can actually cultivate resilience with the right toolkit, be it blogging or otherwise, it would enable them to do something better for their lives.
Okay, I mean, so pardon a little bit of devil's advocate here, but can you break down what exactly you mean by resilience? Because that is one of those buzzwords that is kind of thrown about these days, you know?
Yeah, and that's a fair question, Chris, because actually a lot of people, we all have different ideas about resilience, but even though we have different ideas of resilience, you don't have to have a background in psychology or positive psychology to know what resilience is. In fact, one of the most common metaphors that we attribute to resilience is that of bouncing back. But since I'm doing literature review, I realized that When you dig deeper into the literature, resilience literature, it's not as straightforward as that, because resilience researchers themselves don't know whether it's a skill, it's a process, or it's an outcome. But I'm thinking that it would be more salubrious if we convey a healthy message of what resilience is, and that is that resilience is actually a skill that you can develop it, you can acquire it. That's my kind of idea of resilience. But again, there's no consensus as to what resilience is. If you ask people who have been doing lots of research about resilience, they would have different definition of what resilience is. But essentially for me, resilience is the ability to bounce back, and it's a skill that can be cultivated.
I mean, that's an excellent definition. I think it's almost very academic, isn't it, to realize that we use words a lot in sort of colloquial mm-hmm. language, but then what mm-hmm. those words actually mean is very hotly debated when you start looking into it. So we can see that the really like great marrying with the sort of skills there, and you're sort of doing the research. You mentioned that psych-reg takes up the majority of your time. So firstly, can you tell us a bit more about that? But also, like, how do you manage doing both? If you don't mind me saying, Dennis, you're a very busy guy. You seem to do an awful lot, which is great and wonderful. But how do you do it?
How do I do it? Not healthy, I have to admit. I go to bed probably about 1, and I spend most of my days, with my eyes buried on the screen. It's not healthy. But I like it. I like the sense of achievement. I'm kind of workaholic. So I just try to finish everything. And sometimes I have this silly goal, and it's silly because it's not very healthy, but I have a goal that this week I need to have zero email in my inbox. Ooh. Not for university email, but for work-related email. That's my goal. So probably people would notice that I reply on email straight away, and sometimes those replies are very short. The reason for that is because I want to have zero inbox at least once in a week. So I try to answer them as much as I can. So that's my kind of approach of, doing things, do as much as you can. And then, when you're tired, just go to bed.
Fair enough. So can you tell us a little bit more just about like psych-reg generally? Just tell us a bit about that. Give us the pitch, if you will.
Yes, I'll start with the name because some people struggle to pronounce it. But hopefully when I share to them the story behind psych-reg, it'll make sense to them why it's psych-reg. So psych-reg is basically a portmanteau of two words, psychology and registry. Because when I started it in 2014, it was just basically a directory of people who's got background in psychology and mental health. So that was initially what psych-reg is, and then until I receive a feedback from one of those people that they say it will be a more useful platform if I don't just publish their backgrounds, but actually I give them a chance to publish an article, or if I don't want to publish an article, I publish something which is more informative. So yeah, psych-reg evolved out of becoming a registry. Yeah, so I've been running it since 2014, and I'm quite pleased that in that span of time, I've been recognized by the sector that I'm in, the blogging community. I've been recognized by that. So that's basically the trajectory of psych-reg.
I mean, it's pretty awesome. I think that's fair to say. Like, it's a great idea, and I think you're saying 2014 in an almost very sort of blasé way, right? But that was content creation as we kind of know it now was mm-hmm. not where it was then. So I think stepping into what you did then was the market was a lot smaller back then, right? If you don't mind me asking, how do you kind of feel that like the broader content creation world, I mean, you have a podcast, we're on one now, streaming, mm-hmm. YouTube is massive, mm-hmm. Where do you think those kind of things fit into sort of mental health mm-hmm. and resilience?
You're right, Chris. It's actually quite a saturated sector now. And I suppose I'm quite lucky that I started a bit relatively early in 2014. Because I think if I started, you know, like 2 or 3 years later, it would have been difficult for me. Because even though in 2014, there was already some, established platforms like Psychology Today, Very Well Mind, even BPS Research Digest, and I'm actually competing with them. So it's really good that I've decided that time. So for anyone who's listening, if you want to, you know, like create your own platform, if you want to start on content creation, I think if you really want to do it long time, and that's the key word, long time, start straight away while, you know, still it's not heavily saturated. Because obviously, the earlier that you start, it would be advantageous for you, and also you would gain experience along the way. And then I forgot the second part of the question.
where do you think, like, that, I'm going to say stacks up against, maybe, but, like, you know, like things like vlogging on YouTube, things like podcasts, where do you think they kind of slot in compared to blogging as a form of resilience specifically?
So in terms of mental health, I have to be honest here, because there's an allure of, you know, creating sensational content. Let's say, for instance, that you go to YouTube and you just type anything related to mental health, any keywords related to mental health, and then you will realize, even with the artwork, you realize it's overly dramatic, it's sensationalized, and we don't have to deny that. A lot of people would see that mental health in relation to content creation is being glamorized. And that is because there's a financial incentive. The more eyeballs that you capture, it translates to money. But for those of your background, you know, like doing a PhD or for any academic, that's a challenge for you to be on this industry, be on this sector. Because, you know, with the proliferation of content about mental health, we need something that is really based on science and not just trying to over-glamorize mental health. I hope that I answered your question.
I mean, that's a brilliant answer. And it touches on, I think, a lot of things that are being debated in the spaces, right? You know, you mentioned the sensationalism of mental health. One of my favorite phrases comes from clinical psychologist Dr. Kelly Dunlap, and she sort of says, unfortunately, there is moral entrepreneurism, and people will just try and, you know, include things in a bid to make money, as you kind of point out. I think you also touch on it really nicely in that it's quite difficult when you're in an academic sphere. You know, we talk about the ivory tower, these are the things to actually get out and make sure that you're getting this information that is built on science to everyone and anyone, right? And then lastly, you also have, like, the knowing where your qualifications are from. It's a big thing that, you know, I'm not just targeting, say, like Twitch, for example, but, you know, people who go on and it's not necessarily clear what their qualifications are, but they're, like, you know, doing therapy live and they're talking about things like, you know, and you kind of have to, you know where people are coming from and their expertise, and, you know, from an ethics point of view, doing something like that on, say, Twitch is unethical, in my opinion. It's not something I would do. But it's something that you see happening, right? But it's very, very much, you know, they're the three big challenges, I think, in the mental health space personally at the moment, trying to separate all those out.
Exactly. Like what we're saying is that we really have, you know, the academics, because they're doing a lot of, you know, empirical science about this. So they have to, you know, be actively involved where the people are, where the lay community is, because you can't just blame, you know, these so-called influencers, these so-called content creators, if they're kind of dominating the conversations within mental health, because where are the academics? Where are the scientists? And you can't really say that I'm an academic, therefore I should just restrict my work within academia. But you know, if you're doing research on cyber psychology and you're not really actively engaging with the public, I think there's something missing with, you know, with your advocacy, with your work. So there's just so few academics who are actually engaging in content creation. And let's be honest, you know, like sometimes it's usually just other academics reading other academic work. I understand that they're involved in policy making, but if you want to really, you know, get involved with the lay community, I think content creation is the best avenue to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously I'm going to say I agree, right? Because, you know, I'm in this boat.
Yeah, it's the polite thing to say.
Yeah, it's certainly a bias, right? But I think you are right when you're talking about things that are so universal. And I think one of the things that makes cyber psychology specifically unique is that we all have a grasp of what that is. Like, technology is so important. Everyone is using it. Everyone has opinions on it. I mean, you know, look at even how quickly things can change. Like, NFTs have blown up in the past sort of couple of months, and cryptocurrency in the past sort of, you know, 16 months, 2 years, even more popularized than it ever has been. And like, working in cyber psychology as a field, it feels so much more on the pulse. And I, you know, obviously I agree, but I think being involved in the lay communities is a really, really important part of that. It's not as simple as just saying, right, well, here's my paper, I'm off, I'll see you later, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good what you've pointed out there that, you know, like with cyber psychology, it's really like in front of our face. Like, I mean, although some people will still not have access to the internet, but pretty much everything that we do now is you know, related to cyber psychology. So we can really see, you know, the application of their research. We can see the real life example of cyber psychology. So, yeah, it's really good that, you know, that there's more opportunity for cyber psychologists to get involved with the lay community.
Mm-hmm. So have you got any sort of, like, you know, again, we know how interlinked your work is, especially in relation to, say, the PhD. But have you got anything that you'd really like to sort of point out or highlight for listeners' benefit, or anything that maybe you think is, like, the best of the best?
You mean like anything about my research that I really find
anything that you think is like the best that you've done?
Oh, the best that I've done. It's about to happen yet. Because with my research, I'm trying to launch a blogging platform that aims to promote resilience. So my research project is called PsychRedge Resilience Project. So hopefully, when I finish my PhD, and that's when I finish my PhD, because I'm coming to the stage now where I'm thinking like, is this really a right decision? But anyway, I'm doing it, and if I finish my PhD, I'm trying to launch a platform for adolescents in low and middle income countries, something that would help them to improve their levels of resilience. And I think if I'm able to do that, I'll die a happy researcher. And I'll say to myself, it was worth doing a PhD, because I don't have any plans of being an academic. That's why sometimes I'm thinking whether it's really the right path for me, because I know, you know, the majority of people who you can also speak about this because you're doing a PhD. You know, people who do PhD, they want to be an academic, but I'm not interested with that. I'm not interested with, you know, getting published. The reason why I'm doing a PhD is I want to have a platform which is based on modern psychology. That's all I want. And I want people that when they visit PsychRedge and when they visit my, you know, my resilience toolkit, they can say that this is based on robust science. And hopefully with the help of my supervisors, Dr. Mark Holterhoff and Dr. Laura Cariola, I'll be able to fulfill that ambition.
No, and I think, like, you know, again, I think that's a great thing. Again, I'm biased. I've always blogged myself. You know, it's almost like a bit of a cliche that teenagers have always had diaries, right? Whether it was like written in a little book with a padlock and under the pillow, or as we kind of have moved online in the digital age. But from my personal experience, I agree. I think blogging is important. I think the reflective practice of physically writing things down and then rereading it is very cathartic, as opposed to, and it's not shade at those people, but like getting in front of a camera and ranting for 10 minutes might be like super stress relieving, but like you're not necessarily really reflecting and really controlling those thoughts, right? I think writing is a different process. So yeah, I personally absolutely would say, like, I can see the intrinsic value in that from my experience. You know, when you're saying, you know, if you finish the PhD, you'll finish the PhD. You will. I do also have to agree that I think that the tide is changing a little bit. I think more people are looking at academia and maybe deciding that there are other avenues to go down. Maybe I'm biased. I'm, you know, researching video games, so there are different avenues I could go down. But I think the traditional academic model is less appealing to newer researchers, I think.
Yeah. The thing, though, is that before I came into this country, I was already an academic. I was a lecturer. I was a psychology lecturer. And then before I started my PhD, I was also teaching at a local college. So I already had a bit of experience of how it was to be on academia. And 5 years of that, I think that was enough for me to judge whether it's for me. And yeah, I made a decision, it's not for me. Because number one, I'm not really very academic. I'm not very textbook. In fact, writing my PhD is a bit of a struggle for me, even writing my research project during my PhD, because I write the way I talk. And, you know, when you do your PhD, you're not really expected to write the way you talk. And I'm not speaking ill about the academia, because there's a place for that kind of writing. But it's not really my style to say furthermore or moreover in conclusion. I don't speak like that. So I don't write like that. It's just, you know, like, I just have different, I suppose, skill set. So that's why I don't think I'm going to be an effective academic.
That's fair.
I'm not an academic in the making. Yeah. Okay. Even when, even when I was a lecturer, I think it was a bit difficult for me to deliver a lecture, because I sometimes digress. But you could probably see now.
I mean, I go through the same thing, you know. I mean, you've spoken to me before, Dennis. I love rambling. I think the problem I have is I go the other way, and like, because I just love words, I use so much flamboyant language. Like, I will just casually use furthermore. I like to say it's lovingly pretentious. It's probably just a bit pretentious. It's not because like I love academia. I just love words. But I can definitely, you know, like going back into my PhD, like forcing yourself into that academic box. It's really difficult. I joked with a friend recently, actually, that I speak three languages. I speak English, Scouse, and academic, and four if you include nerd.
Oh, sorry, what was the fourth one?
Four if you include nerd.
Oh, okay, yeah, the nerd language, yeah. We probably speak the same nerd language, because I love creating websites, but probably your nerd language is way, way more fluent than mine. I think it's just like you know when you want to be an academic, it's just kind of like a different kind of environment, because I've also worked in PR, and I'm just thinking that, you know, people in academia would find it challenging working in the PR industry, and people in the PR industry would find it difficult to work in academia. I'll give you an example. Can we edit this? just stream if I say something bad. But because at my university, We had this, I just won't be specific, we had this project. And with this project, we've been talking about it for, and I'm not exaggerating, for over 6 months, yeah? And I was just like, if you're working in the marketing industry, if you haven't done this thing, you'll be sacked. But with academia, there's just so many, you know, filling out forms, bureaucracies, and I won't specify the project, but it's really simple that it could be done by one person. It could be done by even a teenager. But we need to do a chart. We need to do this. And we need to have endless Zoom meetings. In the end, we haven't done anything for the past 8 months. But what I'm saying is that it's just different attitudes, just different approach to work. So that kind of approach will not do well with other industries. In the same way that, you know, I suppose when you're a politician, you probably won't do well with content creation. You probably will, because you're quite good with presenting yourself. But do you know what I mean?
I think if anything, it's important to kind of attest that you have mm-hmm. such an excellent skill set. You know, what we would call transferable mm-hmm. skills, yeah.
So yeah, whatever you choose to do.
So it's like you can see that actually this is that problem X is actually really, really solvable. But when mm-hmm. you put that in the academic sphere, it does get eaten up by things like bureaucracy. I think, you know, yeah. I've kind of always been in like a university kind of environment, working or as a student. Mm-hmm. But like it does, I'm gonna use the term, but it does suffer from it. I agree. I think you can get lost in the red tape. And I think it's really frustrating when you have like a skill set or that you're the knowledge to be able to say, well, actually, this could just be knocked out the park and we could move on with it. I think like you fall into that loop of I always like to use student feedback as an example. Like, you know, like you'll ask, it's like, oh, yeah, student feedback is really important for helping your courses in the university do better. But then it's always a really small percentage that answer surveys. And a majority of those are people that just want to complain. So it's always negative. It's like, well, do you listen to the 20 people that complained and then make a change, assuming that the other sort of 80% that didn't answer? I went 20 people, 80%, that's not actual maths. But, you know, like, and then actually just because you didn't hear from them doesn't mean that you can just make a change, right? So that's kind of my mm-hmm. example of that. You can get lost in this loop of always worrying about what you're doing instead of just, like, doing the thing, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Especially when in like a content world, and I'm not an experienced academic or anything, but it's just kind of like, just do it, you know, like just, okay, let's just do the thing. This project done, mm-hmm. next project, because the beasts move at two different paces, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially if there's a lot of people involved, it just becomes really like a long waiting game, like, what does other person say, and are we doing it the right way? And sometimes also with academia, you tend to pay so much attention on like things that are really non-essential, like let's say semantics. You know, like you sometimes, you know, pay so much attention, things that are so seemingly trivial, and it might be trivial for me, but not for other people. And that sometimes that gets in the way of actually achieving something. And I'm quite really like an output oriented person. Like when I, you know, like when a week has gone, I try to ask myself, what have I actually achieved? And I don't think that it's for me, but I'm not saying that all people within academia works like that, but based from my limited experience, that's how I see it. Even when, you know, I was an academic in Philippines and when I was an academic here, sort of academic, yes, that's pretty much the kind of ecosystem that you will work with. Whereas when I was working at the marketing industry, it's pretty much, it's a brutal environment. If you don't have a thick skin, you can't work on PR. Because, you know, like, you get sworn at. You have to be used to swearing if you work in marketing, and you've got to have a thick face. And I'm quite comfortable with that brutal environment. Yeah. Whereas with academia, I suppose, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that's like part of, it's also just part of the content, like, well, that you have to be able to, you know, just accept that you're going to get, like, I mean, people always say, don't look at the YouTube comments, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's part of I owe it from my marketing experience. I've developed a thick skin, but I have to tell you, Chris, that the first time that I receive a comment and an email, it made me reflect that probably it's not for me. Even with my, you know, my YouTube, I receive a few comments. And then I interviewed someone, Dr. Debbie Hayton. I don't know if you're aware of her. I receive a lot of email asking people previously contributed to PsychReg to take down their contributions because they said they don't want to be associated with a platform that give, you know, platform to persons such as Debbie Hayton. And yeah, things like that. I also receive a lot of things that PsychReg is low value, and sometimes that I'm just trying to monetize people's mental health issues. Eventually, I've developed a thicker skin. I still take those feedback seriously, but I try to be more realistic with my self-reflection. Like, what I ask myself, what made them say that, or what made them request for me to do that? I suppose if you're not receptive of criticism, content creation is not for you, because you will always be judged. Even with your podcast, Chris, I'm quite sure you receive some, you know, not really so friendly comments, but you learn to live with it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I'm not familiar with like the person that you referenced to, and like, you get into this, it's a difficult thing of like choosing, like, even like where you go on to speak to things. Like, I can't say like the shows I've been invited to, maybe yourself, but I haven't gone through like the Rolodex of everyone else they've spoken to, or like even necessarily gone on and said like, well, oh, actually I dislike the way they do X, Y, and Z, so I'm not gonna feature. Because I think at the end of the day, if someone has asked me to speak about a thing, then I can attest to that, and I'm just going to give my opinion, and they're my thoughts, you know, at the end of the day. Whether that is congruent or not with the rest of their views or opinions, and I suppose it's up to them as creators and their viewers to kind of decide if that's for them or not. I think, ultimately, it's the internet, so people are always going to tell you what you've done is not good, because people like to do that for some... I mean, I always say, and this comes from a streamer that I really like, called their Death Unites Us, but he's like, if you don't like the video, you don't have to watch it. So, like, why did you watch the whole hour and then leave a comment saying you didn't like it? Just switch it off. There's an entire internet full of videos. Why watch mine? Like,
exactly. Yeah, but sometimes people think that because it's in front of their face that they have the right to, you know, criticize it. But my kind of, you know, like my mantra now is, I don't really take criticism from someone who can't create. So if you don't create a content, I won't take criticisms from you, because that's the easiest thing to do in life, to criticize other people's creation. But for you to create something that will be criticized, that's another thing. And that's how I see it. And I just want to say something about when you say, you know, like, well, when we're doing content, without naming names, I had a few, shall we say, personality clash with my guests. And yeah, good thing it's pre-recorded, because I won't be able to upload them. But yeah, it's not all perfect with you know, content creation. There are some articles on PsychReg that even though it's my website, I can really do anything with it. There's some articles on PsychReg that I published that I don't want it to be there, but in the spirit of neutrality, I publish it. Probably about a quarter of articles in PsychReg I don't agree with, but I still publish it. And I think that's one thing that you have to bear in mind when you're when you're creating content. We all have our own biases and prejudices, but don't let it influence the way you create content.
No, I think that's a great piece of advice. I think it's, you know, it's, I don't want to spiral into a broader sort of issues, but I think it's what you want to avoid, I think, is like a complete sort of cycle of like what we would call an echo chamber, right? You know, I think it's important to kind of look at all the information and review that yourself. And I think at the end of the day, the skills that you have will give you the ability to review that information. And as you say, at the end of the day, like, people are going to look for and engage with either stuff that they want to because of maybe an inherent bias, or stuff that they just want to dunk on because they can, because it's the internet. But I really appreciate, like, your honesty. Again, I think it just attests to your really varied skill set. You know, I know I'm doing it. I'm still very new to everything. But, like, you're there being like, yeah, I've tried academia. I've done PR. I create content. I'm also doing a PhD. Like, Dennis, when do you sleep, man? Like, you know.
When do I sleep? Yeah, usually 1 in the morning. Yeah. And then I get up about 10. Yeah. But I try to practice self-care. So usually weekend, summer self-care, I have to spend that with my cat and with my husband. It's weird that I put them in the same category. I have to, you know, do something for myself other than just, you know, looking at screen, because it could be quite tiresome, you know, when you're doing it Monday to Friday. So I'll try to do something that I really like. I like going on holidays. So every time I had the opportunity to go on holiday, I'll go on holiday. In fact, just, you know, like December, I went overseas. It actually doubled, almost trebled the price because of all the, you know, measures that you have to. But I'm willing to put up with it, with the financial consequence of that, because for me, that was, I deserve self-care. I've never been, you know, I've never traveled because of the restriction, but, you know, just give me 1 week to do something that I really like.
I mean, that meshes into my next question really nicely, actually. But I was going to say, so when you aren't working, which I understand might be limited, like, what is it that you like to do? So you mentioned self-care, you mentioned going away. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else?
Yes, I love gardening. And back in the day, I also loved to do boot sale. So those were two things that I really enjoyed doing, boot sale and gardening. We have a small garden, and I try to put as many plants that I can salvage from the local garden center.
I mean, do you have much success in the famously poor British weather?
Pretty much, because I try to look for hardy plants, so I would say pretty successful. But don't ask me to name my plants, because I usually forget their names.
I mean, I'll be honest, I know little to nothing about gardening, but I admire people that do it. And obviously, you know, I can appreciate when plants look very nice, you know, but that's about the extent of my knowledge. But I'm happy to learn about things. That's one of my favorite things. So you mentioned you like to travel. You are sort of well traveled. Can you tell us anywhere that you've been that's been some of your standout places that you've visited?
Standout place would be, probably the most recent one, Portugal. That would be the standout one, because it's my first time to travel with a British passport, and also I like the Portuguese language. It's quite difficult to explain it, but there's something attractive with the cadence of the Portuguese language. I can't tell exactly, but it's like, you know, like, it's as elegant as French, but it's still forceful like a German language. And just like you, I love languages, and so that's one thing that stands out from visiting Portugal. I think also another would be, I would say Cambodia, because Cambodia is a poor country, poorer than Philippines. But when you visit Cambodia, there's something about the place, there's something about the people that makes you realize that this might be poor when it comes to GDP, but there's soul in the country, that the people, that the humility of the people. And I suppose it's something because of their religion, they're Buddhist. They're predominantly Buddhist, and so you could smell it. You could smell that kind of approach in life. And so those would be the countries that really pops out: Portugal and Cambodia.
I will say I'm a fan of accents and languages as well. Your accent is adding to the plethora of beautiful voices we've had on site to be with you. One of the episodes in the last season was with a streamer friend of mine called Marco or Solid Snake. He's from Portugal. I legitimately like to check in on his streams, not only because he's a great lad, but for his beautiful Portuguese accent.
Hola, Marco. Yeah, that's one thing I've learned.
He's given me a few idioms, like pon pon queixo queixo, which is a bread is bread, cheese is cheese. And in English,
yeah, even the way you said it, there's something about the language. It's just, you know, it's delicious. If you could just see the language.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. I hard agree. I will also say, I mean, I am appallingly traveled. I listen to someone like yourself, Dennis, and go, I've had a sheltered life. I need to get out more. I hear about all these wonderful experiences and just even traveling on its own is so impressive. I'll be really honest.
I'm actually not well traveled, because I'll tell you what, the furthest that I've been in this country and live in this country for nearly 10 years now is probably York.
York's a lovely city.
Yeah, I'm doing a PhD at the Scottish University, but I've never been to Scotland. how silly is that? Yeah,
I think if anything, though, that's just, it's typically British, right? Like, we're so quick to want to get on a plane somewhere than talk about our own country.
I'd love to explore Britain more. So, you know, when COVID restriction permitting, I'd love to see more of Britain, not just, you know, Essex where I live. You could probably tell from my thick Essex accent, from Essex.
The only way is Essex. Someone of your style, Dennis. I knew I'd seen that on TV.
Yeah, this is not from tanning salon. This is genetics.
I mean, obviously, I'm jealous. That's just also me being a person with albinism and unable to tan at all. But as one of my mates always says, Dennis, when you've got it, you've got it.
Yeah. That's a wonderful beard. You know that it makes you. You know, like it's an asset in academia, because that will make you look more, you know, credible. It adds credible. Beard always adds credibility.
It's really good, like when you're chatting to someone and you're trying to think of a good answer. You can do a bit of misdirection with the beard. I'm thinking. I'm stroking the beard. You know, but yeah, it's one of those. So I always like to ask. I mean, you know, I'm a bit of a nerd myself. But have you got anything that you've sort of like watched? I usually say played, but I don't know if you're a gamer. But have you got anything that you sort of seen, read, or played recently that you'd like to sort of give a mention to?
The Queen's Gambit. It's a Netflix series. I really love that film. I love the character. I love the story. But I'm also into mystery drama. You know, like I'm Columbo guy. You probably haven't heard of Columbo, but I like Columbo. I like Father Brown. That's my kind of thing. But Columbo to me is on a different level. I think the creators of Columbo are a genius, because in spite of, you know, it was created in the 70s and the 80s and there was no, you know, technology, but the plot is just so rich. And I just love every episode of Columbo. I'm also a big fan of, something like war films, you know, like my favorite film is actually something about the Holocaust, Sunshine. I forgot the release year, but something about Holocaust. Those are my kind of films.
Okay, so my next,
and I love reading biographies.
Oh, biographies, nice. Any favorite biographies?
The last one that I've read was the biography of Coco Chanel. I have it here. I love reading biographies, because it makes you realize that some people, they were pretty much given the same time frame as you are, but they made such, you know, colorful life. And it makes you also realize that, you know, you've just got limited time. So you have to make it as interesting as you can. That's one thing that, you know, like I get from reading biographies.
Okay, excellent. So my next sort of trio of questions are all sort of forward thinking. I like to think of them a little bit as uplifting. You've touched on it a little bit already, but kind of if you could tell us what's next for your work, whether that's like literally like within the next sort of 12 months or sort of more aspirational, like where would you like to see it go?
Like what I've told you, I'm actually output oriented. I'm metrics oriented. So I really aim that in the next 10 years, I would have like 1 million visits a month. I look up to big platforms like Psychology Today and Psych Central, Very Well Mind, even the BPS Research Digest. Those are sort of like the stars that I look up to, that I want to be like you. If I get to do that, you know, like just like 1 million visits a month, I'll be very happy. I'll feel I've really achieved something. I can be proud that that's Psychridge, that's my creation. That's my, you know, like my biggest goal.
I think it, in a way, it's kind of good that you have it like as a metric, because that's something really measurable. I think a lot of the times you can have goals that are really woolly, and like almost like saying you've ticked them off can be quite challenging. So it's almost quite nice that you've got that one to tick off. Fun question. If you had no limitations, so you had infinite resources, access to experts, anything like that, what would be your ideal project?
Oh God, that's quite difficult.
Totally, you probably, just say like your blog access tools to everyone for free. Like that's a legit amount.
Yeah, I would probably, yeah, if I've got access to everything, I would probably make Psychridge as big as Psychology Today. Because with Psychridge, I'm trying to, you know, do a number of things. I have a podcast, I have an open access journal, and I host an events, but they're not on the same scale as, you know, other people who are doing it more professionally than I am. So, yeah, if I have the resources, it will allow me to be, you know, kind of, because I have to admit that the conferences that I organize, they really sort of, you know, like, they're not really good. They're not comparable to big conferences. Just like, you know, the last conference that I've organized, there were only 50 participants. So if I have more resources, I'll be able to market it. I'll be able to pay for more speakers. So I short answer is that I'll probably expand Psychridge to be as big as, you know, those big players.
No, that's fair. And the last sort of blue sky one, nice sort of uplifting one, is obviously we can take inspiration from many things and many people. But is there any sort of one person or group that you'd like to give like a little shout out to now for being an inspiration to yourself?
Being an inspiration to me. I'll give one that I just know personally and one that perhaps some of your listeners will know. Mm-hmm. Big shout out would, the first one would go to Miss Lani Sarabia. I don't know her maiden name now, but she's my high school teacher, and she was really a source of inspiration to me. Because when I was 15-year-old, she visited a house in the slum. And after visiting our place, she talked to me and she said that you have to get your family out of here. And I know you can. And that really challenged me as a 15-year-old. I don't know if Mum Lani would listen to this. I'll probably give her the link, because she's my friend on Facebook. But that was such a powerful, I took it as an encouragement. That's a powerful encouragement from her. She's very instrumental in, you know, how I see things in life. That just simple talk. And the second one would probably go to Dr. Jordan Peterson. I read his book, Rules of 12 Rules in Life. And I like one of the things that he said there. He said that before you criticize the world, be sure that your house is in perfect order. And that really resonates with me, especially that I spend most of my time in social media, in Twitter and YouTube. And when you go to these platforms, it's so easy to criticize things. It's easy to criticize, you know, people. But I always think of that quote from Dr. Jordan Peterson, like, before I criticize these things in life, before I criticize people, what have I actually done to improve my life? And so I first do, you know, perhaps it's a bit selfish, but before I engage on anything on Twitter, and, you know, some people probably notice this, I'm quite mute when it comes to Twitter. I just tweet anything related to sacrilege. Other than that, you know, I keep my mouth shut. Because that's kind of my mantra from Dr. Jordan Peterson. It's a big shout out, and I also like his work. His YouTube videos. I'm a big fan of Dr. Jordan Peterson.
I feel inspired from those answers. Like, that's like, oh, that's exciting. I think criticism, like, we just touched on it a little bit before. Mm-hmm. I'm perhaps just not like that well read. But my sort of go-to for that is a Bob Dylan lyric. It's, don't criticize what you can't understand. Mm-hmm. And like that, like, for me, it works in a similar purpose, right? In that, mm-hmm. You know, it's not for me to go in anywhere and just like go shoot my mouth off about X, Y, and mm-hmm. Z without bothering to try and like understand it first. You know, mm-hmm. and that goes to the same for people as well. Like, it's so easy to just say like, this person is doing this and I don't like that. You can see it's cheap and easy win or whatever, but you don't know what that person's like. I think, again, a bit more woolly, but it's like you don't know people's story a lot of the time. You know, one of the reasons I started this, and you're hearing your story today, Dennis, has been incredible, if I'm being honest.
Thank you.
But like, you don't necessarily know that at face value. You might not know that just clicking on like your Twitter page, right? And that, you know, it's like one of the biggest reasons I never try and jump to conclusions with people or things. I think that's a really, really important skill that, let's be honest, I wish more people would apply. So I will sort of say, is there anything else that you'd just like to say or give mention to? And then I've got some quick fire questions that are a bit of fun.
That's it. Ultimately, I think one of my big message is that I'm doing a research on resilience, and perhaps I realize it now, because sometimes you have this idea that when you're doing a PhD, you're going to do something really like world changing. You really have that glamorous idea that you're going to have like an impactful experiment. But for anyone who's listening, It doesn't have to be, you know, like that when you're doing a PhD. It's just like, you know, probably you just have a personal goal, a personal ambition. And for me, resilience, and I might be wrong, I think it's a skill, but I'm willing to be educated more when I'm doing my PhD. And hopefully the next time we meet, I could give more, you know, substantial answers to what resilience is.
No, that's fair enough. Okay, so quick fire, bit of fun. Mm-hmm. The idea is you're going for a trip away. You're going on a retreat. Mm-hmm. You've decided, I need a break. To take with you, you can take one film, one album, one book. And I usually say like one game, sort of board game, video game, whatever you want, something else to entertain you. You're allowed to have box sets and collections. Mm-hmm. That's totally fine, and like whatever you take will magically work because imagination. But my question is, what is it that you take?
Okay, for the film, I think I'll take The Crown, the Netflix series, because I love The Crown. Can I have one more? Downton Abbey as well. Yeah. So I'm really into this period drama aside from murder mystery. Album, I'm not really a music person. And I remembered my teacher saying that those who are not really music, they've got serial killer tendency. But anyway, my song, probably... Waiting for the Star, that's an 80s music. I like that, Waiting for the Star to Fall. Book. I'll probably have Sophie's World. It's a philosophy book. Talks about religion and all that. I like that. Video game. I actually don't play any video games, so I'll just probably take my my abs exercise because I still use that, and probably that's a game because even though I'm trying to do it religiously, I don't seem to see any result.
Fair enough. I mean, for the benefit of listeners, I'm sure that's not true. You know, Dennis is in obviously great shape. You know, we can clearly see that. Check out the video, you can see it for yourself. Okay, one of the last things I like to do before we sort of like properly wrap up is I like to turn the tables and give you the chance to ask me a question. Now, obviously, you know, it'll all be linked in that below, but you've already asked me a bunch of questions in a fantastic interview. But is there anything else that you'd like to ask me?
Yes, and I'm actually asking this on behalf of my husband, because just like you, my husband is also a gamer, so he wants to know what kind of games you're playing.
Oh, okay, that's a great question.
I'll take note of this because I'll forget this.
I mean, generally, I'll play anything. A bit like my taste in music, I'll sample a bit of every genre possible, right? But I think the games that I enjoy playing the most, and you know, we can probably say what this says, you know, about me as a person, but I love like RPG games. So,
RPG. Yeah. I don't know what that means.
So a role-playing game, so games like Pokemon or Final Fantasy, Dragon Age, where you get a ragtag bunch of people, you're usually going to save the world, you start really weak, and you level up and get much better equipment and stats, and then you get able to smack big things really easily, and that fills me with a lot of joy.
I think that's the same game that my husband plays.
You know, it's great. I love huge adventures. I mean, some of the best adventures that I've been on in games have been in RPGs to save the world or beyond. I love your characters. The fact that you can have this diverse group of people with maybe different aims and different views who grow and develop. And then, I don't know, I honestly really enjoy the simple pleasure of like what we call in the business grinding, like just fighting a few random battles to level up and improve your stats and learn new skills. it's something that I enjoy. It's kind of eaped over into, in the past 12 months, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons for the first time. So that's obviously like still role-playing, but actually I get to be the character, and bringing a bit more of that sort of acting out of me is quite fun. But that definitely, that as a genre is probably my favorite. Okay.
I've got something to tell him later.
Yes. Excellent. So as we wrap up, obviously, Dennis, you are rife on the internet, rightly so. But where is the best place for people to find you?
Yeah, the best place to find me is just Google my name, because you'll end up on my website. You'll end up on my university page. On my website, you'll find the things that I do, and obviously Psychridge. I'm also on Twitter, so just type in my name, Dennis Rilohu-Howell. I'm also on YouTube, and then Facebook, LinkedIn.
Excellent.
I don't do Instagram. I feel too old for that.
I mean, I know what Instagram is, but I don't use it. That's how I kind of roll with it. All those links will be attached to wherever you find this episode. Usually below it. That's just where they kind of tend to put stuff. But all that remains for me to do is to say, Dennis, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate it. Like, again, like, your story is incredible. Your plethora of experience, you know, just comes together, I think, excellently for what you want to do. And ultimately, you know, in the business of mental health, is very inspiring and very, very exciting. So no doubt, you know, in the future times, you'll be able to listen back to this and go, smash those goals really easy. Hit that 1 million a month count, no problem.
I hope so. Thank you.
So all that remains to do now is to just say goodbye and move over to the ending screen for our video viewers. But otherwise, thank you all for watching and goodbye.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps.
Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy, look after your mind, body and soul, and I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye bye.